Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, the stubborn stigma of depression for all of us. Fashion designer Kate Spade's sister told the Kansas City Star that Spade, who died by suicide last week, had been reluctant to be hospitalized for depression for fear that word would get out in her industry. The successful fashion icon certainly had the means to seek the best treatment, but embarrassment about coping with a mental illness might have stopped her. So did Anthony Bourdain, the author and television star who died by suicide Thursday night in France. Why, when writers talk about mental illness, musicians go public with their struggles, even politicians and physicians and scientists speak openly about it, is there still so much stigma attached to serious depression? That's our conversation today. As our guests join us, I'd like to urge you to add your voice and your insight to the conversation. Have you been reluctant, even unwilling, to share your own or your family experience with depression? Maybe it's even with your closest friends. What kinds of judgments do you think people make when they don't really understand depression very well? So again, we're talking about the stigma and the barriers to being more open about it, to having more open discussion about it, which is what this show is part of. And I'd like to know your experience with this. If you've been reluctant to share this with friends and family, maybe even some of your closest friends, and whether you fear a judgment will be made and what you perceive that judgment to be. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Let me say this. We have a lot of phone calls coming in already. Please be persistent. I'd like to hear your view. And if you run into a busy signal, call us back. Our guest today, Catherine Cullen, is an associate professor and division chief of child and adolescent psychiatry at the U of M. And with me in the studio, it's a real pleasure to have you back.
Thanks, Carrie. Good morning.
Daphne Merkin is with us. She's the author of This Close to Happy, A Reckoning with Depression. And she's with us today from New York City. And Daphne, I read your piece in the Times, and I'm grateful you could be with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Catherine, the shock that's followed the news of Kate Spade's suicide and Anthony Bourdain's suicide, I think also says something about what we still don't understand about serious depression and some of the stigma that we don't yet still feel open enough to talk about it. What's your read of this?
I agree. I think people still in our society feel that they can't share these kind of experiences, that they fear being judged, whether that's true or not. Most people do have a sense that they'll be judged for having some sort of weakness or some sort of flaw. So many times people keep it to themselves.
So is that what the judgment is, or the fear of the judgment is, that I'll be seen as different, weak, flawed, I don't have control over my life? That's what the perception is?
That's what I think.
Daphne, what do you think of this? Because I know you've written so openly about serious depression.
Yeah. I think it has more to do, I mean, I think some of that is certainly true, but I think people feel all those feelings of being different. I'd put it simply as shame, more specifically about depression than about even other mental illnesses. I think depression, because it's on a recognizable, or so people think, spectrum, with ordinary sadness, disappointment. It's not, in some ways, depression suffers from being both exotic in its extreme form and familiar. Hmm. People don't say, like when I was writing my book, I think it was an actress I'd interviewed, and she said to me, well, everyone's a little depressed, or everyone's depressed. You wouldn't say everyone's a little schizophrenic. By that I mean depression fits a notion people have of their own feelings, but that they're taking better care of their feelings. I think we in this country still have a sort of somewhat puritanical notion that people should, you know, pull themselves together, go to a movie, think of other people, and that somehow that will cure or resolve serious depression, which of course it doesn't. I think the difference between what I would call ordinary sadness and the disease that is depression isn't really understood.
Let's take some calls about that. Interesting to hear Daphne's experience here and Catherine Cullen with us to provide some insight on treatment and therapy. And I'm asking you, as you tune in and you call in, to talk to us about whether you feel that you can share this experience of depression with your friends, maybe coworkers, with family, to Sarah in St. Paul. And Sarah, how does that work in your own life?
Good morning. I suffer from severe depression that is improving, and it is improving through sharing with my coworkers, but they came to me. They reached out to me, and that's what we need to do. And I want that message to go very strongly, that we tell people to reach out, to call a number, to do that. When you are so severely depressed, you can't do that. Someone, you have to see who's missing in your circle of friends, who hasn't answered a text in a while or gone to a happy hour. Reach out to them. But when my coworkers reached out to me, it really changed what I was able to do to help manage my life better. But it was without support, you can't do it.
So, Sarah, I'm just interested in, so your coworkers came to you to say, we think you're struggling. How can we help? Is that how that works?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And they were struggling. I was struggling with my mental health. I was also struggling with my physical health, but they were open to discussing the mental health. I'm a public school teacher, so these are people that we talk about it all the time in our school. And they came to me and they were able to help, and they supported me through really tough times. But, you know, there's so many barriers to getting treatment, and we can do it free with helping and supporting our friends.
Sarah, I'm just going to say I really appreciate the call, and it's somewhat unexpected here. Catherine, is that unusual?
I want to thank Sarah for sharing the story. This is exactly what we need, and it's just a heartwarming example of what we are trying to encourage people to do, which is watching for signs of risk in amongst the people that we live and work and our loved ones, and to reach out to those who we think might be struggling and offer support. So,
but Catherine,
thank you.
This strikes me as a little dicey, though. I mean, you know, somebody that I work with, do I really feel like it is my role to step in to say, I think you're struggling with mental health. I want to let you know I'm here for you.
I see what you mean. You're worried about the risk that you might hurt their feelings by judging.
I might be
invading
their privacy.
Feeling, yeah.
I might be making a judgment that isn't. Yeah.
Well, I think the best situation might be reaching out, having this come from somebody that is a person that you trust and that you know cares about you.
Daphne, in your piece that you wrote for The Times, you said serious depression, which almost always precedes suicide, retains not only the stigma of mental illness and is thus often undisclosed even to one's nearest, but is also a fairly disguisable illness. Most often it leaves no track marks. Well, could you say more about that?
Yeah. I also wanted to say something about, was her name Sarah?
Yeah.
Who called in. I think, not to sound too dark a note, but I think it is rare. I'm not talking about very good friends. I think do reach out. Within work situations, and I, for instance, worked at a very sophisticated magazine, The New Yorker, where you would imagine every second person goes to a therapist, but I found there was one didn't discuss one's depression, in some ways it was considered, I think, compromising. So I'm glad to hear that at the school where Sarah works, they're all, you know, that they're nicely open about it. I'm not sure that's the standard. I wish it would be, and maybe we're getting there.
Right.
I think what I said about disguisability of depression is also what makes it often such a surprise when someone commits suicide who seems functioning, enviably productive, even cheerful, although I think the cheer part begins to fade with depression. But I think it's the whole issue that some people, including myself, except when I've become so depressed that I've been hospitalized, which is something a lot of people don't want, with some good reason. If you continue to function, you can disguise depression. It doesn't come with external cues.
Right. As you were saying, like bandages or a cast.
Right. You're not bleeding, except perhaps inwardly, to keep the metaphor, but you're not overtly showing signs. If anything, depression, I mean, I think I wrote in my book that I used all the wits at my command to sort of act like things were okay, to keep going. It is, in the end, sadly, a disease you can keep to yourself.
Right. Let me take a call here from Anne in St. Paul. Hi, Anne. Have you had this experience?
Yes, I disagree. My experience has been different than Sarah's. I work for a public sector in government, and you know, if you let people know that you have depression, and I do, and I'm dealing with it now, I don't get the feeling that people want that shared. And if you do, then you run the risk of not being promoted or considered for other positions because they don't think that you can do the job. The other part of that is getting the insurance to pay for your disability if you have to go out on FMLA or something and get that approved. Right now, I am dealing with having to appeal because, you know, they don't look at it the same way, even though it says in their contract that they will pay for mental health disability if you are being treated by medical professionals.
So part of this is having to go in to argue that you're in the midst of this and you need this kind of help and you expect the workplace contract to support it.
Right. And then it doesn't, because they can't see. It's like the person said, you know, you don't have a bandage. You're not necessarily in the hospital. I'm going to day treatment. And, you know, I've just learned that I've been depressed for over 10 years. I had no idea, you know. So, you know, what happened was it was a culmination of something that happened at work. And then I actually had to go out on FMLA. And now all of this has come to the surface. And so, yeah, just getting the insurance to pay for it is one thing. But now when I go back, am I going to share that? Probably not.
Right. It's a really good point. Gen Z says here, I hid my depression for years because I feared judgment from everyone I knew. Since getting treatment, I've come out about it. It's a good thing. The important people in my life understand and empathize more than I could have imagined. Can I ask you, Catherine, if you have some thoughts about how to not beyond your just immediate family, how to talk about this in a way that doesn't come back on you as the kind of flawed weakness that we talked about at the beginning?
I think it's different for each person, and people aren't going to typically be ready to broadcast the news right off the bat, and they're going to want to try it out discussing things more openly with trusted people like family and other loved ones and their care providers. And then I think once a person has more understanding about what the depression means for them and how it impacts their life, they'll be more ready to talk with others. So and some people might never reach that point, or they might have a real unfortunate but societal need to keep things private. For example, one of the callers mentioned, you know, that she didn't think she'd get promoted. Some reasons like that. So there might be situations where health conditions do need to stay private, but that doesn't mean that we can't talk about these things in other settings.
You work with kids and adolescents. What do you tell them about this?
So when, for example, after a kid's been in the hospital after a suicide attempt, we encourage kids to only share the information with whom they feel comfortable. They don't need to provide an explanation for why they were gone when they returned to school. They may choose to share with their closest friends. So it's about where it's about themselves feeling comfortable and getting that support they need.
A listener on Twitter here says, I was diagnosed with depression, sought support, watched for the symptoms. I don't tell people only because how does somebody bring this up in conversations with those around you? It's not a natural or light topic to bring up with friends and acquaintances. Daphne, how before, as you were edging out into this world where you were going to talk about this more openly, how did you think about what this listener on Twitter is raising? How do I bring this up among people that...
Well, I still don't. I have a passage in my book where I'm standing at a cocktail party and someone says to me, you know, you're standard, how are you? You're not going to answer with, I'm terribly depressed. I mean, my decision, and it began many years ago when I wrote a piece for The New Yorker called The Black Season, mm-hmm. My decision was more based on the fact, precisely because depression is sort of silent, I wanted to give voice to it. Giving voice to it in writing, even though it's a kind of personal confession, if you will, is not the exact same as telling people who I deal with in everyday life that I'm depressed. I think the issue does become more work life versus private life, because I tend to agree with the two women who said they didn't find great responsiveness or wasn't easy to talk in one's work life.
Wow.
And I don't think, I mean, in many ways, when we talk about mental illness or emotional illness, it remains for many people, even if they have their own problems, the dark side of the moon if you try and articulate it. So I don't think there's an easy route like just saying, well, let's all be more open about it in society.
Right.
There are reasons people are not. Because one of the callers in said, you know, then maybe she wouldn't be promoted.
Right.
You can't stop other people's judgments.
Well, I mean, in some ways, I think more acknowledgement and more open, real conversation about it, Daphne. I don't want to give up on that.
No,
you know what I'm saying, right?
Conversation helps, although you happen to mention earlier, I don't think it's actually accurate that Kate Spade's sister, who was later seen to be as a somewhat problematic source, was just as I was writing the piece, I started to write a whole thing about how it was a pity she didn't want to go, you know, she didn't want to seek therapy.
Yes.
Because it would compromise her brand. But she was in therapy for 5 years. Her husband said that.
I read that as she did not want to be hospitalized, did not want to seek therapy.
Right, but hospitalization, having written openly about it and seeing it as akin to admitting you've killed your mother. Hospitalization is a wholly other issue. I mean, that's something people, when I heard about Kate Spade, I thought, why wasn't she either hospitalized or being watched by someone else, which is also a possibility, is like not leaving a very depressed person alone. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of hesitation about going into hospitals. It's a statement about yourself, especially if people know.
Mm-hmm.
It does separate you out. And quite frankly, since I've talked at psychiatric hospitals, a lot of them aren't particularly, if one is looking for nurturing or a way to sort of get back to one's prior, less depressed self, they're not always that helpful. They're helpful at keeping you from killing yourself.
In the moment.
In the moment.
Yeah. Catherine, what do you think of that? This how we see hospitalization and what Daphne just said.
I agree that hospitalization isn't necessarily a cure, a way to cure depression. It is a, typically hospital stays are on the short side these days. They used to be longer. Now they're something like 5 days or a week usually. And so by the end of the hospital stay, patients with severe depression and suicidal thinking aren't cured, but hopefully the crisis, they're kind of more crisis management.
I mean, is that what a hospitalization is often for? Just intervening in the moment in the crisis?
Making sure that the person is safe during the crisis, yes.
And do you think we culturally have a different perception of, as Daphne suggests, of what it means to be hospitalized for severe depression than even if people say, well, I'm on medication?
Absolutely. Why? People have so many fears of the psychiatric hospital based on like popular
pop culture.
Yeah, movies, yeah. And One Who Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and things. So, I think the reality is very different from what the public believes.
Understands about it.
And it is, being in the hospital is a necessary part of care for some people, and it can be helpful, and it's not the only answer. It's part of a spectrum of interventions that include, sometimes medication, psychotherapy, involvement of the family, other things.
Catherine Cullen is one of our guests this morning. If you've just tuned in, she's Division Chief of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. And Daphne Merkin is with us. She's author of This Close to Happy, A Reckoning with Depression. It's a discussion that we're really digging into now about the unwillingness for good reasons, as I'm hearing this morning, to share experience with severe depression with maybe some of the people that are closest to you and maybe the world at large, although we are also talking about how the more knowledge that many of us consume about what depression is and what severe depression is and the best treatments for that, maybe we prevent some of that stigmatizing around it. If you've had some experience with this, you don't talk about it, you can call this morning, 651-227-6000. And on Twitter at CarrieNPR to Kayla in Minneapolis. And Kayla, thanks so much for waiting.
Hi.
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 You were diagnosed with depression in college, is that right?
Yes, yeah. So about 10 years ago, and after a family history of depression, I remember my mom dealing with it when I was younger and thinking, why didn't she just snap out of it? When I have talked with new friends or coworkers about my depression, they often say, oh, well, you seem so normal, which is good because I'm taking my medication and I'm handling it and I'm reaching out to my support system. And what I wanted to add to the discussion is normal is good, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're cured and fixed. And like my doctor says, if I had diabetes, I would take my medicine and there wouldn't be any sort of societal stereotype to that,
right.
But it seems often that the thought that I need to take my brain meds every morning, I can't just snap out of it, is sometimes skewed within society. And just the continuity of my routine is something that helps me stay on track.
Kayla, I'm interested in how many people you felt you could be open with in college after you got the diagnosis.
Not many, but that I don't know if that was necessarily the scenario or if it was just me coming to terms with it.
What do you mean?
Well, I may not have given my college community the benefit of the doubt because I didn't want to seem like I was burdening people with my problems. But there definitely was a month when I thought, I can kick this in the butt and I can just beat it. So I went off my meds and I stopped going to class and I just slept. And there was many collegiate consequences to that. And all my goldfish died and it was not a good day. It was not a good period. But then getting back on the horse and being like, no, I need assistance. I need help. And again, talking with my friends and family and having them be like, hey, you good? But just the ongoing process of it all. Even if someone, quote unquote, is perceived as being, quote unquote, good, it doesn't mean that they don't necessarily still need support.
Good to have a call, Kayla. Thanks. Thanks for tackling the question, too. A listener here who tweets as Belgian Friar Paul says, my experience as clergy is that honesty about anxiety, depression among clergy can have serious repercussions on one's career. The church often does more harm than good with its clergy in these matters. Daphne, I don't know if you've investigated that at all in your writing. Does that surprise you? That the church?
No, it doesn't surprise me.
Why?
Well, I mean, to get sort of like a social perspective, the church is, whatever else it is, an institution. Like, I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't feel the Orthodox Jewish community, or I would go to my rabbi and discuss my depression, because I think some of the response is to sort of close ranks. I mean, we have still, and I don't know why this wouldn't exempt the church or a synagogue. In general, I would say the notions of emotional illness, mental illness, remain fairly primitive.
I see.
You know, that you're, I think that caller just used the term, but you seem so normal.
Right.
You know, the notion that, I mean, all people have problems. And in some way, I think it says something that I've always been struck that people in AA or some kind of drug rehab are so open about it. You know, they merrily go on, certainly celebrities and even non-celebrities merrily will say to you, I'm in AA, I was in rehab, and my somewhat skeptical mind thinks there's something fashionable, if one can use that word, about being in rehab, that depression doesn't have that kind of cachet. I think it also threatens other people. It's interesting, when I was writing the piece about Kate Spade, and it was right before Anthony Bourdain committed suicide, I said to the psychiatrist I was interviewing, who was a specialist on suicide, do you think suicide is contagious? You know, we know that it is among teenagers, that they can have copycat suicides. But I think people fear if they get too close to a very depressed person, it'll rub off on them.
Yeah, I don't want to miss what you just said about the cachet of rehab and what we were saying, the stigma of hospitalization. Catherine, has Daphne put her finger on something here that we really, and I don't know why this would be, that we look at rehab as something that a lot of people go through and it's kind of cool to do it in a way that we don't see treatment for serious mental illness?
I think it's complex. I think there are quite a number of people out there, maybe some listeners that struggle with addiction and don't feel that they it's something that they're proud of or that they can be open about, and it is also something that they need to keep a secret. So I'm not exactly sure. I don't think I can say for sure that having depression, I don't think has ever been fashionable. Maybe if between the two, depression is kept hidden a bit more. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I mean, 20% of people will experience, like Daphne said, it occurs on a spectrum, and we all have some sad feelings and periods of down times, but 20% of people will have a severe episode at some point.
Wow.
So it's a huge amount. It's part of the human experience in a way. And so I think I'm not sure about cachet, but it's a very common problem.
If you're trying to get in on the phone lines here, pretty busy lines, try me back. You can also reach us on Twitter at Kerri, KerriMPR. And if you're getting into the show late, I want to let you know that you'll find it on the podcast. Some excellent calls here and some interesting insight from our guests this morning, so you can find it later on the podcast. We'll get a look at the latest news, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Daphne Merkin and Catherine Cullen. Stephen, what are you leading with this hour?
Kerri, the White House says President Donald Trump plans to visit U.S. military bases in Guam and Hawaii on the return from his historic summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. That travel itinerary update comes hours after the president announced that he will be leaving Singapore early because the nuclear negotiations have moved, quote, more quickly than expected. That was before the two had even met, and it was not clear whether it was good news or not. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that states can clean up their voting rolls by targeting people who haven't cast ballots in a while. The justices rejected by a 5-4 vote today arguments in a case from Ohio that the practice violates a federal law intended to increase the ranks of registered voters. Pope Francis has accepted the resignation of the bishop at the center of Chile's clerical sex abuse scandal and two others as he launches the purge of a church that has lost its credibility under an avalanche of accusations of abuse and cover-up. A Vatican statement today said Francis had accepted the resignations of Bishop Juan Barros, Bishop Gonzalo Duarte, and Bishop Christian Caro. A small plane has crashed in southern Wisconsin, killing 4 family members. The Greene County Sheriff's Office says the crash happened yesterday about a mile north of the Monroe Municipal Airport. Local television reports the pilot was a grandmother and 3 passengers were her 2 children and their mother. Federal officials are investigating. Good chance of showers and thunderstorms scattered across the region today, and some are producing heavy rain as we speak. Time now, 11:39.
Programming is supported by the law firm of Dorsey & Whitney, providing healthcare companies with comprehensive, coordinated legal care. More information online at dorsey.com/healthcare.
On the next NPR News Presents, Ovik Roy has some ideas to fix America's health system, and he says the longer we wait, the harder it will be. Roy believes we can have universal coverage and make the system financially viable. Hear him Monday at noon and 9 p.m.
I mentioned a minute ago that you could find this show on the podcast. What are you listening to right now? Our show last week on how immigrations and customs, how ICE performs, and who polices them? Where's the accountability of ICE? And I did a show called What the Hell, DFL, given all the dramatic political maneuvering going on. You can find that on the podcast. Search NPR News with Kerri Miller wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Support comes from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, honoring Penumbra Theater's Sarah Bellamy, Daniel Rodriguez of Merrick Community Services, and others with Public Leadership Awards Tuesday, June 26th. More at hhh.umn.edu.
Back to our discussion now. Lori tweets in to say, sometimes the simple gesture of mentioning depression and briefly stating what's going through your mind alleviates the internal struggle. That acceptance that this is what is going on is meaningful. To Christina in Minneapolis. And Christina, I know it's been a while. Thanks so much for waiting. Tell me
no
your
problem.
Story. Yeah, your story with this.
I attempted last year suicide, and I'm happy that it wasn't successful. I just want to say of the 2 celebrities who did accomplish it, I try not to pay attention too much to their particular stories, because if I would have succeeded, I wouldn't appreciate too much about my personal life being divulged. But it's unfortunate that they are gone, but it is good that we're talking about it now. And depression is something that's been obvious to people who know me because it comes and it goes.
Uh-huh.
And I have been embarrassed, and I have thought sometimes that it's my fault that I haven't tried hard enough to fix myself, or the medicine, I'm not doing it right, or I haven't been paying attention in counseling. I want to point out that I was hospitalized for a few days, and that actually gave me validation. And then the people who knew me, it actually helped them as well, because I've had comments like, well, why don't you just exercise more or something? So it's an educational thing, I think. And I think that with just example like the Me Too movement, there can be some education, and this can be brought to the forefront, and it can be worked with, and it could be recognized, and it surely could help the people who are depressed not be so quiet about it, and
okay.
The people who have loved ones that are depressed could learn how to reach out more. And that's my main concern, is I appreciate hearing from the specialists about
good.
Depression and suicide. But
Christina, I want to, if I may, I want to take something that you said back to Daphne, which is, Daphne, where does, why don't you exercise more? Gee, you look so, does that come from just a simply uninformed place, or does it come from a place of, you're the other and I don't want to catch this, or, you know, I don't have to deal with this, so somehow there's something wrong with you that isn't wrong with me. How do you see
right.
that?
I tend to think it has more to do with the second part of what you said, which is, I don't want to catch this, in some way saying, why don't you exercise? I mean, although exercise, as we all know by now, produces endorphins, I think it's, which would help with depression, I think it's also a way of keeping the severity of the situation at bay.
I see.
And I just wanted to qualify one thing I said about cachet. I wasn't for a minute saying there aren't plenty of people who struggle with drug addiction silently. I was talking more about cultural cachet, that one doesn't, that one can talk. I mean, it interests me that Anthony Bourdain, for instance, openly and repeatedly discussed his drug addiction.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But did not talk about his depression much,
good,
if at all.
Good point. Right.
He referred to dark moods.
Right.
And I think that's instructive. You know, whether it's a celebrity or not a celebrity, the choice is, it's still easier for some reason to talk about drug addiction. It doesn't incriminate you. I think many people who suffer from depression, including me, feel that it says it's self-incriminating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thus the shame part.
I think this is an interesting question Christina's raising on Twitter here, Catherine. She says, and it speaks to what Daphne was just saying, are there different generational perceptions on talking about depression? It seems younger generations are becoming more open about their mental health challenges. Maybe there's hope that younger generations may work to change the social stigmas. Now, you work with kids. Do you find that?
I work with adolescents, and I absolutely think there is a generational difference in perceptions about depression. I mean, I think back to medical school when I was working with World War II veterans who were, you know, in their 80s and 90s. And I mean, they had a completely different, you know, perspective on mental health and depression and, you know, pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps, et cetera. I mean, there has been a lot of education and, you know, outreach efforts. And I think kids today are much more informed about mental health and what to watch for. My kids are in junior high. They're learning it in health class about depression and the symptoms of it. And so I think that, I think that's a very, very good step forward.
A call here from Ada Linda in Minneapolis. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I work primarily with Latino and immigrant families in a local high school and have had incredible supervisors. And I've learned that reframing the approach from a primarily Western clinical model that focuses on the individual and kind of creates a distance between the healthy versus the people with mental illness, to discussing like sadness and worry and fear as a part of, you know, the human experience, like someone mentioned, and then instances when it becomes toxic or overwhelming. That kind of approach has really helped me get to the parents that are a little bit more resistant, and even the kids that are also more resistant. And then taking a systemic approach where, you know, the sadness and fear is not just like, oh, here's my broken kid, why don't you fix them, because we're fine. So like a community sadness, or even a sadness of the family, and that's really helped me like work with the families and even the school. And the school is great at working with this too, where the healing becomes an everyone thing. So it's not just like you are depressed, therefore you are not as resilient, but it becomes more as like, you know, we as a community somehow like need to do something about this. And that's really helped me work better with you know, my culture and my population, even my own family.
This is really interesting. Changing the language made a difference. Do you find, Ada Linda, that when you're talking to the parents about kids who may be going through this, that they react much the way that Catherine and Daphne have been describing, that it's a character flaw, pull yourself? I mean, are you still seeing that, I guess, in parents that age, probably in their 30s and 40s?
I am, and there's a big, as I've learned, you know, from like the director of my school, there's a big community shame, that not only the shame of the parents, like I have failed, I can't keep my family together or my kid together. And then the, you know, the normal shame of like my kid's on drugs or suicidal.
Right.
And then, you know, like, why are you so weak? Why are, when I was growing up, blah, 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 you know, it wasn't like this. Why can't you handle it? You know, I've given you everything as I immigrated to this country. So yeah, there's anger, there's shame. And then there's like, in Spanish, I've learned it's called pena ajena, which is like shame of somebody else. Like you feel shame for the other person. So the families, you know, will look at the other family with the kids struggling with depression.
Jeez.
And will have this like shame. And then when their kids, you know, for whatever reason, start struggling with depression, it's like doubly overwhelming.
Oh, that's so much pressure on the kids.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting learning experience. And thankfully, I have like great mentors. So now as I'm learning, a lot of it is also modeling, you know. So when I've been stressed as a therapist in a high school, I will come in and tell the kids, like, I am having a really bad day right now. And, you know, they see, you know, because I'm Latina as well, they see me talking about this in an open way. And then later I've had kids say, wow, like, I felt like that too. So that's really been an approach that I think has helped, which in the past I didn't have that approach. I, you know, came out of grad school having a very typical clinical individualistic approach, and wasn't as successful in reaching the families the way I hoped for.
It's really good to have your call. I'm glad you heard the show and you had a chance to call in. Thanks a lot. Daphne, there was something I wanted to bring up that I saw kicking into gear on social media, and that is the fact that Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain were the parents of young daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was an immediate, well, this is this is primarily a selfish act.
Right.
I know you've thought about this.
Yes. And I alluded to it in my piece on Kate Spade and said, you know, I don't agree. I think from the outside in, and I also wrote, I mean, I've also written about how my own daughter probably has kept me in this world, you know, when I've had suicidal thoughts. But I think if you get to that place, you are either thinking they're all better off without me, including the daughter or son, or you've ceased connecting in that way. You have somehow moved, you know, depression. depression can do a real number on human connection. You pull back, you recede, you retreat. The loving love needs, those kind of things get kind of pushed to the side, I think. I think it's too, it's self-righteous in a way, the way the word selfish is tossed around. Meaning, the person is implicitly saying, well, I would never do this. I have a daughter.
Yes, that's right. That's a judgment.
I have a son.
For sure.
I would never do this. And the truth is, you can't speak out of non-knowledge of the acute desperation that goes along with severe depression and suicidal wishes.
Daphne, I really appreciate the insight this morning and the benefit of your writing about this and your investigation. Thank you for the time.
Thank you so much.
Daphne Merkin is the author of This Close to Happy, A Reckoning with Depression. And Catherine, if I may, I want to bring up something that Daphne raised there at the end, which is what happens when someone becomes kind of locked into the ideation around suicide. I want to understand this better from the outside looking in. So what goes on?
So we've talked about depression occurring on a spectrum from everyday experience to the severe depression that requires hospital. Suicidal thoughts also occur on a spectrum. And so someone might have, we don't consider any suicidal thoughts to be normal, but or to really be acceptable or not worth commenting on or looking into further or addressing. But a lot of people will have suicidal thoughts that are passing, that they don't feel that they would follow up on, and which aren't too disturbing. All the way to more severe suicidal thoughts with a plan, with the intention of going through that plan and things. And so, and when we assess risk for suicide, part of the thing, one of the things we do is look at risk factors, look at supports. We will ask, what is keeping you from suicide? Is there something? And some people will say, you know, well, it's because of my 13-year-old daughter or my family or my parents. I wouldn't want to hurt them.
What Daphne was saying for her sometimes.
Yep. And
right.
And sometimes it's my religion. There are, you know, in the more severe forms, you know, people will have such severe thinking that they say, you know, but now even that isn't enough. Like it's, you know, their thinking has changed from, you know, well, it'll hurt, you know, it'll hurt my parents if I kill myself too. They'll actually be better off if I die.
Here's the other thing that comes up with that is from people who have not been through this or have not experienced severe depression. What happened with Anthony Bourdain following so quickly after Kate Spade looks almost impulsive. And that's a presumption I'm not saying that I'm making, but when you're not informed enough about this, that's how it looks.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to imagine that suicide is in any way impulsive, but help me understand that.
It can be planned well in advance, and it can be completely impulsive and decided on in the spur of the moment. It really varies.
Really?
Yes. People can set a date and go through extensive preparations. And there are other cases where something happens, their thinking changes, and they make the decision in the moment. So there's more than one way.
Mm-hmm. Call here from Janet in Minneapolis. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I have recently had a young teen family member attempt suicide. Fortunately, was not successful. As one of the few who are in the circle that hold that confidence, I don't really know how to reach out to her or what I should do. When I'm with her, I tend to just kind of ignore it, hug her, tell her I love her, but I don't know if I should be doing something more to open a conversation with her or just let things happen?
Good question. What do you think, Catherine?
So far, so good. I think being there as a support person, telling you love her, giving her a hug is a great start. She may or may not want to open up to you, but I think offering that opportunity and just saying, you know, I'm willing to talk. I understand. I know, you know, other people that have had similar situations, or giving her some sort of offering to normalize it a little bit, or to say, you know, it's okay to talk about with me. This isn't, you know, I'm not going to judge you, and just continue to offer that love and support.
Janet, are you there?
I am.
Have you, so how does that sound? I mean, does that sound like something that's doable, or are you looking for more specific guidance?
That sounds very doable. I've looked online, you know, I've Googled to see if there are things for, you know, something I should read, resources that talk about it that would give me some guidance, but that may be the best advice that I can take.
Okay, good. I wish you well with that. John called in to say, Catherine, I work with middle school students. The social media pressure students makes them feel like they're not fitting in. But it's also created a space for students and adults to find help and community for mental health problems. Double-edged sword of social media. How do you look at it?
I agree. Double-edged sword is a great way to describe it. The social media phenomenon has provided avenues for kids to bully each other, but also support each other, connect in positive and negative ways. Since kids are so heavily into texting and using social media as avenues for reaching out, we often encourage the texting hotlines okay. for them, because they feel that it's more approachable than, for example, calling on the phone. They don't really use the regular phone that much. They are more familiar with texting. So there is a texting hotline that I think it's 741-741.
We'll
we can share
number.
It. Yeah. You know, I think that just social media and use of those avenues is something that is very good for parents to keep an eye on, and how is the kid using it, and making sure that it's not causing too much harm for kids.
Jonathan says on Twitter, depression equals no instant fix. Try one med, take 6 months to know if it's working or not. 6 months to wean off of it. Now try the next. Then he says, it works. I feel better. I'll stop taking it. Now that pill won't work anymore. I think this is a reminder of there's no quick fix to this. It's once you get help, then your problems are over.
Someone said earlier that her doctor likened it to diabetes, which is another chronic illness. And this is oftentimes something that waxes and wanes, and we need to keep working. Yes, sometimes people do need multiple treatments. The first one doesn't work, but the key is eventually we will find something that does work to help the person. So it's important to really have hope and think in the long term.
Catherine, thanks. Good to have you in the studio. That crisis text line in Minnesota is 741-741. And you can text if a phone call doesn't work. That's the text, and that's your opportunity for help.